This episode of The Blotter Presents is brought to you in part by Best Evidence subscribers. Thanks so much, guys. The Best Evidence newsletter is a great place to get the latest on big name cases and to let us know about the headlines on your minds. You can find that at bestevidence.fyi. And now, the podcast.
Well, I don't think any of us expected you to come today, given the...
Terrible thing. But crime still needs solving.
Two cases that, strictly speaking, remain unsolved. Two cases that were overshadowed to the point of pitch darkness by other stories in the United States. Taken on by two Hall of Fame directors. AMC's quiz wonders not just who wanted to be a millionaire, but how badly and by what means. And Alex Gibney's No Stone Unturned asks who wasn't compromised in the corrupt so-called investigation into the 1994 Lachlan Island massacre. Sun never sets on the British tabloids. It's The Blotter Presents, episode 145. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, a podcast that looks at how true crime is told and sold. I'm thrilled to welcome Best Evidence contributor and first-time guest, Margaret Howie, to the podcast today. Hello, Margaret.
Hey, how's it going?
Well, you know, it's 2020, so...
Yeah.
enough said,
sorry,
I'm sure.
Yeah, it's a sentence in itself.
Yeah. But just in case, before we get started with the podcast proper, I will mention that it feels, frankly, superfluous and awkward at this crisis point in American history to be discussing two properties which really could not have fewer Black lives in them if they were Sex and the City, particularly given how much of the content The Blotter Presents considers generally is confronting the grievous injustice of Black lives not mattering. So I just wanted to acknowledge that to talk about anything else might seem strange, and it does to us too, to a certain extent. But Black Lives Matter, our conversation about the guy from Ripper Street cheating on a game show, does not change that fact. So let us then get to it with our most wanted section. We are talking about Quiz, which is in the midst of airing on AMC in the States right now. It has already aired in the UK. Here's the case file from Vulture's Explainer, which is linked in our show notes. Quote, following a mediocre first day on the chair where Ingram used two of his lifelines on easy questions on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, Ingram spectacularly bounced back upon his return, changing his answers at an erratic and confusing pace that made the British show's host, Chris Tarrant, visibly confused on several occasions. Ingram would go on to win the £1 million prize, only for the production company to launch an investigation into irregularities for his game. What ensued was a made-for-the-tabloids criminal trial that alleged Ingram conspired with his wife, Diana Ingram, and fellow player Tekwin Whittock for them to cough when Ingram read an answer aloud, indicating that it was correct. The trio were found guilty of procuring the execution of a valuable security by deception, although to this day the couple maintain their innocence. End quote. We got screeners, and I have seen the whole thing. What did you think of it overall, Margaret?
Overall, I enjoyed it. I was worried they were going to do that thing of showing us, you know, half the story and then going back and showing it all in a different light, which is just super lazy. Mm-hmm. And they were a bit more interesting than that, though. They were definitely, when it started and the Picasso quote started up about art and truth, my eyes rolled so hard I almost sprained them.
yeah. Wasn't encouraging, but I did feel like this is directed by Stephen Frears, whose work includes Dangerous Liaisons, which I just thought was it was interesting that that was the first property of his that leapt to my mind. Not sure what that says, but I thought this was well done. I think the subject matter is pretty much exactly what is like needed or appealing right now in some ways. Like it can feel a bit quaint, I guess, with everything else that's going on. But I did find it interesting because I'm interested in how frauds are perpetrated. And I thought the show did a pretty good job, given that a lot of it is from Charles and Diana's point of view, but because Charles and Diana still maintain their innocence, they kind of can't take a position on how it was done when nobody is admitting that it was done. Did you think that they threaded that needle effectively?
I think they did. I think you can definitely tell in places that this was originally a stage play, but it almost works that it was a stage play because it's about various levels of being performative. And the fact that, you know, Charles and Diana are sort of this very, like, they're such a meaty subject. It's because for me, the thing that was fascinating is that why was this such a cultural obsession? Like, why is this case was so huge at the time in England? I wasn't living in the UK at the time, but I remember it being big then. Even when I moved here, it was something that would still get referred to a lot. And I mentioned this show to a friend the other week, and they actually burst out in anger, like, I just can't believe they won't admit that they did it.
Really?
Where the hell does this come from? And I thought it did a good job not only, you know, dividing up the line between, you know, is this, at the time I think the question was, is this fair? And now we're like, well, is it true? Which does seem a little bit on the nose 2020, but it's very diverting. And I watched the whole thing in one big rush. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I liked it a lot. The performances were fantastic. I thought they did a good job making Charles and Diana as, you know, characters in this, like, sympathetic, but also not. You really were able to pick a side, and the script wasn't really pushing one point of view or another. But going back to what you were saying about why this became such a, not cause celeb, but like preoccupation, let's say, in the UK, you called for a clip early on where, I guess this is the, is this the Crown attorney who's...
This is the Crown attorney, yeah.
Okay.
So this is the prosecutor.
So let's hear that clip, and then you can talk a little bit about why you called for that.
Who wanted to be a millionaire? My God, these three certainly did. You are facing a 50-50. Guilty or not guilty? The Crown believes the answer to be self-evident. They are guilty as charged.
Dun, dun. Done.
So I made a note, something like British Johnny Cochran, when I saw this, because it's so completely Rumpole of the Bailey. It's really over the top. And I think it nails the fact that what this silly, inconsequential, you know, this is a nothing case, isn't it? But it was literally no one was hurt. Well, at the time, we didn't think anyone was hurt. We've since found out, you know, that some bad things did happen to people, but it's just this nothing case, particularly in the shadow of 9/11. And then you've got this massive sense of, but some, they didn't do it properly. And I think, thinking about it, I think the reason this case became so huge in this country was there's a sense of, they didn't do this the right way. You're meant to do things the proper way. And, you know, this isn't on. These people should not have, like, tried to break the rules like this. We don't take that. And it's quite, I think, a British attitude of, like, this should be fair play. Whether or not the game is fair doesn't matter. The point is that you should play by the rules.
Well, and you had a note somewhere else about something that we talked about in a recent episode, that it's like there are certain cases out of the UK that have to do with, or the size of them and the public's reaction to them have to do with class issues that Americans don't get. So I don't know if you want to speak to that, but you had a note in our rundown doc suggesting that this might have had to do with class concerns that weren't really spoken of because they wouldn't need to be for people there.
Definitely. When I started watching it, I'm like, well, this has got to be, where are the class lines? And as soon as you kind of get the shots of them at home in this, you know, nice, like Surrey or wherever they're from, nice sort of, you know, old, probably a 300-year-old cottage and kind of poddling along. And it's very Middle England sort of shot. And it's very much that, you know, the feeling of being aspirational from that kind of person is not considered cool. They did this grubby thing of trying to get on a game show and get on it several times. For what? For money? It's not on. This isn't working class aspiration, and this isn't posh people having a laugh, you know, or whatever they do with money. I wouldn't know. But there's something about, they're not doing it the right way. You know, this is not something that good, solid Middle England people do, which is something so, you know, sort of, I guess, seedy or there's also a joy, I think, the clip of the Crown lawyer is this absolute schadenfreude and rubbing their faces in the fact that if they did this, they fucked it up so bad.
Well, yeah, that's the other thing, that it's like, not only did you show your ass, but you showed it like tilted 90 degrees the wrong direction. Like there's definitely this sense that this is what Edith Wharton would have called striving behavior. That it's like sort of late 19th century capital S society in New York would have been like, it would be like having an actress to a dinner party kind of stuff. that it's not on, like you said.
So there's something in it about Diana and her brother's fandom and the kind of the quote unquote syndicate's fandom is shown in this kind of quite like, you know, the show kind of goes back and forth at how it's portraying them, but they're obsessive. They're not liking the thing in the kind of the big picture. And I think the big picture as this was originally presented in the tabloids, etc. They're not liking the thing in the right way.
Yeah. I'm going to jump ahead to clip 4, which I pulled because this is Diana talking about how they're going to write a book with all their tips and tricks. And this immediately put me in mind of the guy who unseated the Jeopardy champion and was then champion himself for a while. It's called Prisoner of Trebekistan. And this guy is, or at least at the time, was partnered with Jane Espenson, the Buffy writer. And it just put me in mind of that and of how he had like a whole chapter about how the whole trick on Jeopardy is buzzer timing and having a quick thumb and the way that people will become sort of ensorcelled by these details in a way that I think for some people is very off-putting. So I think Quiz did a good job sort of illuminating that kind of person, but not judging them. This clip also includes the production staff being like, look, something's not right here.
Yeah.
So I want to talk a little bit about the portrayal of the production staff as well, but I'm mostly including this because I think the relationship between Diana and Adrian, her brother, is handled in an interesting and subtle way, and I want to talk about that too. But first, here's clip 4.
I suppose I should tell you we're thinking of writing a book about the show. Just a little simple how-to with all the hints and tips and things we've learned, so we can pass them on to new contestants.
Just all that cheating stuff.
It isn't cheating.
Yes, but is it cheating?
I've asked Ruth Settle to join us. She's our head of PR at Celador.
Yeah, this is Nicola Howson, who's our head of press, to do likewise, because I think we can all agree that this is a flipping nightmare.
I'll say. I saw it for the first time in a while last night. No offence. And, okay, I'll say it. It was effing boring. No offence. The contestants are all... they all look and sound.
Yeah, well, they all talk to one another as well. It's like they know each other and they're somehow sort of helping each other.
Is that against the rules?
It's against the spirit of the rules.
They're getting on and they're getting bolder.
And we think it almost feels like something's coming.
There's so many interesting things in this clip. First of all, that there is an attempt, which is quickly brushed aside, to point out the utter lack of diversity in the prospective contestants.
It's as close as they get. Yeah. I wish they'd hit that a little bit harder. But hey.
Yeah. I think there's another scene where they're like, do you notice anything that all of these contestants share? And it's just classic, doughy, white, you know, hideous collared shirt dudes.
But there's also a bit where Diana says they don't like people like us on the show. Something like, you know, they don't want our kind. And there's something about her sort of sense of a fan's grievance that she's not what's right for the show that I thought was something they could have got into a bit, is exactly what the chip on her shoulder is. But yeah.
And that the right after this, the executive of color is the one who's like, why don't you just let us cast it? Then we don't have these problems. And they're like, no. But there's also the sense coming from the creators of the show that an offense has been committed against a public trust. But it's like, well, but it's a game show, friend. Yeah. Bring it down a notch. But the relationship between Diana and Adrian, like, it's not that relationship really needs illuminating, but there could have been a whole episode just on Adrian's like ineptitude at life, but they're quite elliptical about it. And the ways in which he is this like dramatic, this like melodramatic, but also monomaniacal in his like pursuit of getting into that chair. I think in the States, they would have dwelt on that in a miniseries about this and just been like, what, but why? Like sometimes people, what's the expression? There's nowt queers folk. Like
nowt queers folk. So they just be like that. Like we know those guys. I've been to enough, you know, pub quizzes to have seen three of those guys huddled in a corner at a table. And you think, well, that's it. We're definitely coming no more than second. They're those guys. Yeah. And there's something about the fact that it's kind of Diana and her brother's relationship is kind of presented as like, this is what this is. You know, he's showing up all the time at the family house, even though Charles is a bit like, what's your brother doing here again?
Yeah. Well, and I find that somewhat relatable that it's like, there are whatever sibling mind things that my husband is like, why are you guys like this? And it's like, I don't know. We just are.
Yeah. Yeah.
Especially with card games. That's our family kink. But I thought they did a good job just saying, like, you know, this kind of person exists, and this kind of person is, you know, like this sort of in-law familial situation is a, you know, relatably frequent drag, and we have nothing else to say about it, which was refreshing.
Very much so, yeah. I kind of towards the end of the series, I was a bit like, so wait, what, he's running away from his debtors into Wales or something? I could have had a couple of lines of dialogue explaining exactly what the dude was doing in a trailer park in Wales, but, you know, it was all right.
Did you? Yeah, but my sense was that there was an implication that he didn't actually need to be on the lam and that he was being a drama king. Is that just me?
No, I absolutely got that. I just could have, like, I think I kind of wanted to have that dug into a bit because it was right. So peculiar with him and his, it was very drama king, like four beepers. Okay.
Yeah. Well, and it's the way that shot is composed with it next to a can of Sterno, because he's in a, he's in a camper, that it's like, oh my gosh, like this, I would watch an episode about this guy just being intense about quizzing himself on like rivers of the world. Anyway.
Well, racking up debt, which again gets us into the murky world of class, because compared to his sibling, he's clearly not doing as well. And that's definitely some striving action happening in there, which is caused a trifle unbecoming, I'm sure our lawyer friend might say.
Yeah, just a trifle. Another aspect of this that I would cheerfully have watched more episodes on is, although I suspect that it's one of those things where they gave me just the right amount, and if I did have any more, it would be like, oh, this is too much of this. the network executives and the creators of the show and the like stupid network tricks that are going on almost constantly. We heard some of it in the previous clip. And then there's a clip from earlier in the first episode that you called for, which I considered selecting as our leadoff clip because, I mean, what a fantastic pitch in clip three.
Fusty old game show.
It's not a game show. It's a quiz. That's the joy of it. People love a good pub quiz. A uniquely British invention, combining our two greatest loves, drinking and being right.
I mean, I should get that tattooed on my face, first of all, because my great loves are also drinking and being right. Sniff. Also, and bagging on Errol relatable. Morris. But I think that might have a hint of the class issues in it as well. That he's trying to sort of position this as something that's either classier than the other guy was making it sound, or more appealing to more classes in British society. I don't know if that's true. It's just something that's on my mind now.
I hadn't thought about it like that, but I think there's something in it because there's definitely a split between game shows, which are those things on during daytime that unemployed people watch, where traditionally often in British TV, you got really crap prizes if you got a prize at all. Because of course, the BBC would have had game shows where they can't give out cash prizes, so you'd get like a pencil case or something. Okay. But then there's also another strand of British TV, which is the high-end kind of intelligence quizzing style, which is Mastermind. I don't know if Mastermind's on anymore, and I know it was franchised all over the world, but Mastermind was very iconic and heavy, which was just all about being super right about things that absolutely don't matter. And one that does live and is an incredible cultural institution is University Challenge.
Oh, sure.
Which is, again, it's all over the world, but it's a thing. I once tried to explain to a French person while an entire like pub was in deep, intense silence watching University Challenge going on the TV. And they were just like, what is this British shit? And I'm like, no, it's a whole thing. Like, it's really a massive cultural thing. There's, you know, books about it. There's a rom-com with James McAvoy about it. You know, I had a friend who was on it and briefly trended on Twitter, like, when his episode came on. So, and that's, I think, sort of this aspirational idea. And I think there's almost a thing of, you know, for the show's creators, the stakes couldn't be higher. And that's the idea behind Millionaire, isn't it? Is that like the stakes really are high, which is ironic given that this case is about something where the stakes could not be lower.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Even the creators and the network are like, but I mean, do we call the police? And like, who? Like, which police do we even call? Like, it's just a TV show and they haven't won yet. And I was fascinated by those like process discussions of like, once you discover that something has gone horribly awry, and once you or realize that there's some other malfeasance on your reality show, like this is something that's been on Survivor fans' minds here in the States since last year, because this fucking Grabby Dan, who was not, like, his accusers were not believed on the show, and then he grabs a producer and then they make him leave. Like, I'm always interested in like how is the show being constructed and like which realities are they applying, because you know, they're seeing the show from the back and we're seeing it from the front. So here is an early conversation featuring the useless Lionel from Legal about what they're going to do about this problem.
Before anything else, the most urgent thing is whether to air tomorrow's episode, because if we don't, then 10 million people are going to need something else to watch.
I have a tape on it where you can see for yourself.
But what about the police?
The police?
Yeah.
Is this a police?
Well, it's not.
It's theft. It's £1 million.
If this was a bank vault or a diamond store in Hatton Gardens, there'd be helicopters by now. Roadblocks.
Well, right. See for yourself.
All I'm saying is it a crime to cheat on a game show?
Well, it's well.
Stop saying well, Lionel.
I'm from legal. It's my job to say well.
Lionel 2020. Yeah, here again, I think you're seeing a bit of, you know, the show taking itself and its role in society extremely seriously, and also secondarily this urge to punish the strivers for trying to game the game.
Yeah, it reminded me a bit, you know, of like the McDonald's Monopoly scandal, which, yeah, you know, and how, you know, when that hit, loads of people were like, they what? They did what? I got some of those tokens and we never won anything. I mean, you know, I bought Monopoly McDonald's tokens and we didn't win shit. though I've managed to work through my grievance since. But yeah, it's this great peek at what the machine is behind all this. And there are massive gray areas, but that, you know, the cognitive bias has kind of already kicked in. You know, the main producer, Paul Smith, is like, this, they've done this, they've cheated. We, whatever we have to do to, you know, eliminate this, we have to eliminate it.
And there's always that aspect. And I think when I talked about McMillions with Dr. Marcia Chatelain, who is back next week, by the way, to talk about Dirty John, we were thinking about the sometimes outsized responses to, like, cheating on a quiz show, both here, like back in the 50s, and Herb Semple just died yesterday, actually.
Wow.
May he rest. That there's this outsized response to these, like, relatively small time, like, that they are frauds. It's fraudulent behavior, and I'm not saying it shouldn't be charged or punished, but there also seems to be this performative aspect by society, both in response to these scandals in the culture and the coverage, but also in the legal community, that it's like, we must maintain the illusion that fairness exists and is possible, yeah, to that it is possible to prosecute offenses against it. And it always ends up being these, like, steroids in baseball, that it's like, yeah, is this that big of a deal?
It's like the show's got this complicit understanding between the audience and the creators, which is, you know, we understand things might go behind the scenes, but we want the narrative you're selling us to be more or less what you're selling us. And right, the narrative of Millionaire is, oh my God, if someone that just happens to know the capital of Namibia, they too could transform their lives and look like, you know, get to outsmarm Chris Tennant, which would be a prize, right, in itself. But if you break that, then some, my God, society, like, that's it, downhill, civilization over, you know, we're just going to be end up thrashing on the banks of the Tiber.
Well, that, yeah. And there is a, you know, elemental, fundamental unfairness to life that I think everyone on Earth for like 98% of the time just agrees not to discuss or acknowledge. And so you have relatively unserious frauds like this where the reactions are disproportionate because everybody would prefer to go along with the illusion that everything's fine. Life is fair. There's, yeah, still a middle class. You can get, yep, into an Ivy League university all by yourself. So that's
everything you earned is all yours, and because you're really great, and if you didn't, yeah, earn it, it's because you weren't good enough and just need to work harder. There's something about this, and I feel it's like with reality TV, for instance, you know, when we watch it, we know that it's not quote unquote real, but we also believe that there are certain things that there are rules of the game.
Right.
But it also helps that when something like a game show someone cheats on, we don't have to systematically restructure society to make it any better. We just, like, send the tabloids after them and put them in jail. It's really simple.
Yeah. And then you can sort of
my nose. I haven't got to change my life.
Yeah. And it's like, it wasn't our money, But
yeah,
there, you know, there's definitely something to this idea that punishing transgressions of this type lets us feel like, you know, all transgressions will be punished. Justice really is blind, and all of these other things that, like, when someone is screaming, "Wake up, sheeple," in your face, you're just like, "But I don't want to."
No,
because it's hard out there. And the last few months around the world have made it not impossible, but more difficult to, like, get a, like, rage boner about stuff like this. So it's very interesting to, like, anthropologically unpack the response to something like this, because certainly there are things in American sport where people will just freak out, and it's like, but didn't we know everyone in cycling was doping? Like, didn't we know that Mark McGwire was doing steroids, and we elected not to care because the result was really exciting entertainment? And then once he is, like, shamed and brought low, and they won't vote him into the Hall of Fame, maybe we can all feel better about the racist criminal justice system.
Yeah,
I'm not
exactly
a sociologist. I don't know what I'm talking about, but I think there's something to it.
But also American sport, for it, just to choose one. I mean, I think there might be, I mean, I'm not an expert. I think there might be some other issues there. Like, what if
I don't know what you could possibly mean. Certainly nothing that rhymes with Schmappernick.
So, yeah, but it's, yeah. So if we put on these little, you know, I mean, show trial is way too, like, tacky a thing to say, but we put on this, you know, this big, get really hit up about this one thing and really enjoy it. You know, I mean, the Schadenfreude is never too far away.
Well, sure. I mean, maybe a better example would be Operation Varsity Blues, with, like, Lori Loughlin and all of these people, that it's like, you know, this is like the tip of the tip of the tip of an, of the iceberg next to the actual iceberg.
Yeah.
But at least we can maybe feel better about our own chances if these people are just, like, scolded by life. But it won't really change anything. So anyway, there was another interesting bit in the defense case that I wanted to play a clip from. This is the defense attorney who is talking about the nature of memory, which they've done many studies on this, and this is something that you hear constantly in regards to like compromised testimony and wrongful convictions, the ability of police to influence interrogations for people with intellectual delays, children, so on and so forth. And that it's brought up here, I thought was a really interesting point, because the whole case centers on the nature of memory and, like, remembering facts. And here's this, like, almost expert testimony from the defense attorney talking about the nature of how we remember things in clip 6.
Another of my favorite facts, given that that's what this trial is all about: right answers, wrong answers, knowledge, truth, is that when we're remembering something, we're not actually recalling the original event. What we're doing is we're remembering the last time we remembered it. So we are constantly wiping our pasts and editing together a new one. One that makes sense to us now, in the present. All memories are therefore, by definition, a lie. They change. We change them, which isn't a crime, a conspiracy, just human nature.
Yeah, I mean, I thought that was really, like, well argued, and I deliberately stayed away from any information about the outcome of this until I watched it. But based on that, I was a bit surprised that the jury didn't go for it. But
I think something, when I watched that scene, I remember thinking, isn't it interesting how in, I think it was 2003 or so, the trial was, we as society have, unfortunately, unfortunately, been forced to deal with the construction of reality and what is truth much more.
Yeah.
And I think one of the streams of that, I think, is the rise of true crime and understanding about testimony and confessions and eyewitness, and the idea of memory being quite unreliable has become something that is much more the public foresight. Like, I think now most of us hear that and go, well, yeah, cool. Yep, cognitive biases, memory is, you know, not reliable. But almost 20 years ago, I feel that there wasn't something that we were talking about very much more.
Yeah, that's true. All right, we have one last clip from Quiz, which you called for. And I think this goes back to to our central Striver thread. Shall I play the clip and then we can discuss?
Hit it.
It's going to be all right. I promise. Some silly people just think Mummy and Daddy did that silly thing, that's all.
Well, did you?
I mean, for a start, Shan Clifford is amazing in this. I've never seen Fleabag, so I wasn't really familiar with her, but she's got this big Karen energy that she brings, and the weaponization of the word silly there is something I've had directed to me by a certain breed of British women that almost, to me, it's as if she feels like if she can just sum up enough contempt for the people accusing her of doing this thing, they will somehow, like, dissipate. Like, she can just, you know, relay over how ridiculous she thinks the whole thing is, they will just be forced to wither in front of it, and sadly they've not. And I just thought she was the most interesting character. And by necessity, the show is very much about Charles. But she's the interesting one, like, by far.
Yeah, there's a moment where he's like, can we not with all of this? And she's like, we've been following you around for your career for how long? Like, now I want a thing. So get with the program. And he doesn't really have anything to say to that, because I just feel like he's someone who doesn't have a lot to say. Period.
Yeah.
He's just
there's not much
filler.
Yeah. I was wondering, and this is a bit of a wild here, but, you know, if there was a shadow of PTSD happening with him, because we hear a bit about his military experience and it's awful. And, you know, he feels very pliable in his marriage and kind of passive aggressive at most. And then there is a point in which he just breaks down in front of his commanding officer.
Yeah.
And I think McFadden does a really good job of kind of showing this kind of fragility, but also, you know, we understand why she's so caught up in it, but he's got something else. He's got some other hole inside him that he's trying to fill.
Well, and I think the implication as well is that he understands his marriage and his family in along axes of obligation that tie into his work, and that his way of perceiving and ordering the world is a little different when it comes to obligations than to you or me. So I thought that was well done, and I thought they didn't underline that part of it too much.
No. No, I didn't want to have the trauma of Charles at all. I was really glad the way they handled it.
No, there was no need for a Bosnia flashback to be like, and, you know, this is something relatively small that he can control. And sometimes you don't need the psychology. I feel like I say this a lot on here, that sometimes, like, there's always this drive with true crime to be like, but why? And it's like, well, sometimes when it comes to serial killers, it's like, they're serial killers.
Yeah.
They kill people. They like to do it. They're sadists.
Mm.
That's the why. And if you want to understand why there's the why, you're not a serial killer and it's not available to you.
Yeah, there's some things that are fundamentally inaccessible.
Yes, and exactly.
Yeah. I listened to the podcast that accompanies this, which is by the makers of, and they said something interesting that McFadden, so apparently Shan Clifford would come to set almost every day and be like, oh, I've decided that they definitely did it. And then some days she'd be like, nope, they didn't do it. It's all like, so she would constantly go back and forth. But apparently Matthew McFadden never said one way or another what he believed. which I thought was a really interesting choice. Yeah, he just, you know, he was playing what was on paper.
Yeah.
But he wasn't committing to, like, they did this or not, which I thought was partly maybe why it worked so well.
Yeah, and that's, I think, I mean, that's a different style of acting. I think my husband would have been unable to leave it ambiguous. But this is someone who, like, when he was on a soap opera, made up a whole backstory and, like, a middle name for his character. And it's like, it's, you know, this is daytime TV.
Yeah.
It's just a stalker. Don't overthink it. But, like, because I know him, I watched this old footage and I can see him thinking about the fact that his character's middle name is Orson. Like, you know what? That's your process, like, and that's great. But in this case, with a case that was so huge and incited such extreme reactions, to be, like, exactly in the middle between the two poles as the actor must have been really difficult. I will say this character is close enough to what I have seen him play on Succession that part of it might have been just like, well, I already have this in my bag.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's, yeah, I mean, it's really good. There's not a dull moment. I wouldn't say I could have done without the violence done to a pet, which is not necessarily telegraphed.
Yeah, I want to, like, make sure we mention that, because, you know, it does come out of nowhere and it is quite bloody. And if that was something that really triggered me, I would be behind the couch because it wasn't subtle at all.
Yeah, there will be, you know, someone is like, what is that? And then it appears to be blood on the floor. For the next 5 minutes, you don't need to be a part of that, I would say.
It's not the brother who's not come back and is, like, been hacked to death by one of his imaginary debtors.
Yeah, exactly. So, but with the exception of that, I think this was a really well done 3 hours. I almost wished it was a little longer so that we could see, or that the network executives would get a spinoff, because they were great.
They were so great. I loved all the processy stuff. I loved, you know, the characters, or even if they only had a minute on screen, you knew exactly who this person was.
Yep. And there's a conversation about Disney. Mickey Mouse is in the building. Could you try to be cool? It's extremely well done. And I recommend it, except for the dog part, and you will know when to turn away.
Yeah.
All right, moving on to our cold case section. We are discussing a relatively recent documentary from Alex Gibney. It is called No Stone Unturned. Here's the case file from Owen Gleiberman's review for Variety. We will link to that in the show notes as well. Quote, on the night of June 18th, 1994, two gunmen wearing boiler suits and balaclavas burst into the pub and opened fire with assault rifles, killing 6 of the patrons, all of them Catholic. The massacre took place during the World Cup, when the bar was packed with people who had gathered to watch the Republic of Ireland face off against Italy. It was quickly established that the gunmen were members of the Ulster Volunteer Force, the loyalist paramilitary group that might roughly be described as the loyalist equivalent of the IRA. Parenthetically, he says, the moment you apply a word like equivalent to the Troubles, you're looking for trouble, but that, I believe, is an accurate assessment. The massacre was headline news around the world, but Gibney felt the shock and horror of seeing people he'd fraternized with attacked. His movie is a detective story that investigates the truth of what happened. Who exactly were the gunmen? And why, for years, did the crime remain unsolved? Gibney, like many observers, alleges a cover-up, one that reaches to the highest levels of the British government, and he offers convincing evidence. Yet in a strange way, the movie, as doggedly made as it is, remains stubbornly uncompelling, end quote. I don't usually use reviews for the case file because I want to kind of leave it as, like, blandly logline-y as I can manage, unless I hated the thing, in which case, let's dropkick it. But I wanted to leave that in because that is exactly where I landed with it, and I'm struggling to figure out why. I think other reviews I read were like, Gibney was too close to this and his lack of perspective means that he's not aware of where the rhythms of the storytelling aren't working, but I'm not totally sure that's it. I will say that overall, relative to other Gibney product, this felt like a lesser light, and I'm looking forward to hearing both what you thought, Margaret, and like talking through why I landed where I did. So what did you think of it generally?
I think I liked it a bit more than you, but I had the exact same reservations in terms of, you know, when it opens up with this fairly dinky die reconstruction, which looks like it was done for a budget of about £3.
Oh yeah. And really the slow-mo on the assault rifle, like, dude, like phrasing.
Yikes. But, and then they kind of recap what happened, and then we get 50-minute explainer as to what the troubles are. So if your kid's doing the troubles and, you know, you want to homeschool them, chuck them in front of this and they'll get a nice little timeline. And I think it was about 50 minutes in, oh, we're going to get back to the murders. So I think I used the line like Gibney catnip. Like, it's just completely ticks all his interests. It's got a conspiracy. It's got, you know, a murder. It's got like the chance to fossick through the archives and have a gotcha moment. But it also very much comes like the man is a documentary making machine, and this feels very much like a machine made product.
Yeah, which is strange because I think I believe that the release of this was delayed, or like it didn't make a film festival it was supposed to be in because of legal issues, and like one of the producers violated an Official Secrets Act, or allegedly did. And I am on the record, listeners know, as having zero problem with like personal involvement in the subject or subjectivity. Like, I think that that adds to a documentary project's like how compelling it is, and how like perspective is perspective. Like, any documentary, there are choices made, even if that choice is to like not be personally involved in it. It's not a transcript. So I have no, that he was like horrified to find that people that he had hung out with on another project for another project had, you know, ties to this massacre. Like, it's a massacre, and it is horrifying. And the extent to which official like investigative business was perverted by the troubles really can't be understated. But I also feel like maybe if you read Say Nothing, you should not watch this movie, because that was a much more direct and accepting of the realities. Like, this just kind of read to me like, you know, Thanksgiving with that second year uni student who just discovered that COINTELPRO exists. That it's like, again, stop yelling wake up sheeple in my face. I'm aware of what the troubles are, and it's not that we shouldn't be clutching our pearls about these, you know, subversions of justice, but I feel like Gibney thinks that he is gotcha-ing those involved. And this viewer was kind of like,
Like, the people involved, like the people involved in these things have had far worse things happen to them than Alex Gibney making an irate movie. And yeah. You know, that's not gonna shake the, you know, British government like all that much.
Yeah.
They really, like, you know, the bloody history of colonization has told us that much. It really is gonna take a little bit more than you being really angry. It's not like, while he's personally close to it, I felt like it might have suffered for the fact that I get the impression a lot of this was made from America. Like, I think, you know, I think Gibney's based in New York, and I'm like, yeah, there's a lot of stock footage here. There's a lot of footage I think was farmed out to another production team in Ireland. He showed up, did the interviews, came back, did some editing. They, you know, went on the internet a lot, but it doesn't feel like it was the boots on the ground, this kind of case, which is maybe why we end up with, you know, large stretches of it being like, you know, someone says, well, we think there might have been collusion. Right. 3 minutes on what collusion is. Back to the story. Okay, we all know what collusion is, team, right? Pop quiz, cool. Now we're going to go into back to the actual story, which, yeah, does just kind of disappears for half the movie.
Yeah, so here's how very American, or sort of Sarah American, Gibney is. Not only has he lived in my hometown, but I'm not sure if they're still married, actually, but he was married in the early 80s to my seventh grade homeroom teacher's daughter. Oh, Debevoise forever. So I've always felt sort of close to him for that reason, although I've never met him or Debevoise Jr. But like I said, there was this sense of the not ugly American, but just like naive American to certain aspects of life and continuing grievance in other countries. And just this sort of sophomoric, like, what? Like, guy, you're much too good at this to bring this attitude into this work. Like, it just felt unconsidered, and like someone else on the production team maybe ought to have said, like, I'm not sure this is the angle of revelation that you want. I want to talk about another aspect of the revelations in a second, but first I want to suggest that this might have been more effective if he had framed it in terms of what other events in the States would have overshadowed this for Americans, because in the first property that we talked about, the very first clip we heard, the reason the execs are surprised that the cops came is because it was 9/11 when all of this started blowing up in Quiz. You may have noted from the case file that this occurred June 18th, 1994. If you don't remember what happened June 17th, there was a certain low-speed chase involving a white Bronco containing Mr. O.J. Simpson, and I think the reason that this case perhaps didn't, like, I think it made headlines, and we'll hear the footage in a second, but I think it disappeared pretty quickly below the horizon after that, thanks to Mr. Simpson. Here's clip 8.
This made world news.
Former football great O.J. Simpson and his lawyers are preparing for tomorrow's arraignment on double murder charges. Meanwhile, police in Northern Ireland are hunting for two gunmen after the worst violence there in months. The men killed 6 people while they were watching Ireland's World Cup soccer match.
I thought the police can't let this go. I mean, the eyes of the world are on them. They have to be seen to be doing the right thing here.
Well, you'd think that, but I think nobody really understood while we were in it just how much of the sun OJ was going to blot out for a year and a half.
Exactly.
Do you think that if he had taken the stance of like, here are some things that America paid no attention to because of OJ, and then followed this thread, that it would have worked better?
I think there could be something in that. I think also, I wonder if there's something in how the news was reported in the UK. If there was a feeling of fatigue about the troubles. And
yeah, that's an interesting question too.
Because you know, they do talk about, and like, in contrast to Quiz, which is a story that hit the news headlines, stayed there forever, and is now currently being relitigated yet again, as there's a handbagging between Chris Tarrant and Charles Ingram all over again. They say, you know, this story disappeared. Like, and OJ, I think, had a part in that. But also the nature of what news was like back then. You know, there wasn't internet, there wasn't a grassroots media movement for them to even grab on, and whoever was telling the story. Because I think he kind of makes a gesture at saying the people telling the story deliberately, like, didn't want it heard. But also, yeah, there were a lot of reasons that the story didn't make it out.
Yeah. You know? And there's also
I think
the fact that
got into it.
Oh, sorry, what was that?
Which is, it could have got into it, but I feel like the murder case at the heart of this, the actual massacre, just gets lost in the telling.
And there's the fact that if you are just realizing that, again, with the tip of the iceberg, but like that this is just one of many horrendous examples, not just of senseless killing, but of failure to prosecute it effectively, thanks to compromised people all the way up to Downing Street, that, you know, there's nothing wrong with admitting that A, you had no idea the extent, and B, that you're willing to bet your fellow Americans also have no idea of the extent, because unless they were Irish nationals, everybody else was looking in the direction of Rockingham. Okay. So,
yeah.
And look, many mistakes were made by all of us, but just take that angle and own your own like belated shock. I think that would have worked better.
It's not necessarily a conspiracy that this case didn't get, that like rural Ireland wasn't as big as, you know, the guy who's on the Naked Gun movies.
Well, yeah. I mean, look, I was standing around actually British national friend's living room wailing Nordberg and drinking homemade wine. Like,
right.
What else could you do?
Right. Yeah.
The fact that the investigation itself is off screen for so long did, thank you for pointing that out, because I was wondering for myself why it seemed hard for me to like plug into the actual story. Like my attention sort of kept wandering away from it and I was doing other things. You know, again, there's other things happening in the world for us right now, but like, this isn't an uninteresting story of an investigation that got fucked into a cocked hat. So why isn't this more compelling? Once he finally gets back to it, here's an investigator for the, I guess, the panel or the reinvestigation.
Yeah, the kind of truth and reconciliation panel, that one.
Right.
That,
yeah. Escaped
me.
Yeah, this was their investigator who was just talking about the fact that he basically had to start from scratch because, among other reasons, the crime scene, which was the car, they like threw it in the garbage.
Yeah. Woo.
I mean, and that reenactment actually was quite, I thought that was quite effective, that it just sort of disappeared into this heap of scrap. Anyway, here's clip 9.
What is utterly frustrating is the poor investigative practice conducted by the police. There was no forensic examination of the field afterwards. And I know sometimes it sounds as though what you're going to do with the field, but actually the potential to harvest evidence from a field is very good. You know, the relevance of things like botany, vegetation, soil typing. If you can take soil samples from somebody's shoes or clothing, what you can do is potentially connect somebody to the field. If you can connect them to the field, you may be able to connect them to the car. You know, it's a rolling process. But if you don't conduct that and you don't gather it in the first instance, you lose the opportunity to do that.
You know, this moment comes 45 minutes into the film.
It's such a great part. I marked that clip myself.
Yeah.
And that's the stuff that, like, you could put that all in the foreground and have the troubles in the background.
Yeah. I mean, eventually you'll get to the troubles. Like, they're not, that's why we don't call them the B-list candy. They're called the troubles. You're going to get there. I'm not sure we need, like, the history lesson up front. And then by the time he gets to what was, I think, an overlong tracing of the guns that were used, from Libya all the way to da-da-da-da, and why wasn't this transport stopped, and all these other things, it's become a lot harder to just get a handhold on the story, because I think he put things in the wrong order, because he was like horrified in a way that was structurally inappropriate to making a really good movie. I don't know if that makes any sense.
No, it totally makes sense. There's this, because there is that great stuff about the forensics and the guns, because they found the car, they found the guns, and it wasn't, they were just like in a field, like a wee bit away.
Yeah.
And instead of being like, right, here are the guns, this is what we think happened, we've managed to track this back, instead it's like, well, so Gaddafi. Now, do you know who Gaddafi was, children? And we get this, you know, little discourse on what happened with smuggling weapons into Ireland during the Troubles. And I get, like, either make that your movie or don't.
Yeah.
You know, either just assume that we can wiki that stuff later, or, you know, like, show me, don't tell me.
Or, but, I mean, yeah. It, like, Morgan Spurlock is a different filmmaker, and that's fine. And this isn't for everyone, but, like, just get a, like, put an animation.
Mm.
Like, it'll take 15 seconds. Like, just do an animation and be like, and well, here's Colonel Gaddafi. Like, you know,
yeah.
We know. Like, we're watching a documentary about a political murder. What? Why don't you assume? And, you know, it wasn't made in 86. It was made in 2016. Yeah. So we all have smartphones. We got this.
I think it's, yeah, and Gibbo is usually really good at kind of doing fun, formal things. Like,
yeah.
You know, throwing in extra stuff. And he's kind of disappointingly just sticks to his talking heads and the occasional reconstruction here, which just, and stock footage that we've all, I'm sorry, seen a lot of.
Yeah. I think that we've actually probably cracked the problem, which is this. I think that Gibney, generally speaking, is quite good at structuring complicated cases of, like, corporate malfeasance. Like, why was this a big deal that, you know, Elliot Spitzer, you know, used sex workers, whatever. That he understands what his lead is, and he takes you through it in an orderly fashion that isn't dull. Like, I'm thinking specifically of the episode of Dirty Money season one that he directed about the Volkswagen fuel emissions scandal. And it's like, that seems pretty obscure, and like, it's gonna be a tough sell in terms of story, and it gets a little tricksy, but he's very good at ordering these things and, like, getting to the thriller heart of stuff that can look like boring paperwork. Here, I think it was a much more emotionally driven storyboarding, and for that reason, his usual excellent sense for the right structure for his story eluded him.
I think you've nailed it. It's, you know, for a guy who's really good at making things that seem boring fascinating, this isn't boring. And he kind of struggles with something that is both, like, he's close to it, it's emotional, it's not boring. How do we actually get this down?
Yeah, I mean, he just needed something, or either that, or he just needed to come into it via a different door, because the other problem is there's no there, really? Like, why wasn't this solved? Well, we know why. The Troubles, corruption. An hour and 50 minutes now? We're just going to be mad about that for 2 hours? Like, it, I don't know. It just doesn't, it never quite goes. Here is a very short clip that is kind of where the movie lost me. That he's so obviously needing an indictment of the killers as serial killers, and needing everyone on camera to kind of, I don't know, agree when everyone already does agree. Like, I don't think there's any argument about the fact that this was that these murders were murders and tragic, but here's clip 10.
How exactly would you characterize person A?
I would characterize him as, or characterize them all, as ruthless. Absolutely ruthless.
Serial killer?
By definition, yes.
There's just something a little bit sad to me about the fact that, like, I have no issue with him, you know, leaving himself on the in the sound. That's fine. But just that he's like, they're serial killers, right? And this investigator's like, yeah.
Yeah.
Like,
Yeah, what do you he want cringes, from me? He's always yes. cringing a bit, like, you know, I mean, I get it. And Gibney's usually a really good interviewer, but yeah, that part stuck out to me. It was like, are you trying to get a pull quote for the trailer? Like, are you trying to drag, like, do you want to make this a true crime, like something that's like got all the true crime aspects and then drags people in that way? Which is, you know, something a lot of like filmmakers and podcast makers have done to get people interested in social justice.
Sure.
And then like give us our vegetables by throwing us like, you know, the Troubles history. But I just, it goes nowhere. There's not enough of, there's not enough tension. And it's just not satisfying.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, to reframe people who committed multiple murders in this political framework, like, I'm absolutely not absolving anyone of anything. Hmm. But to reframe them as serial killers seems a little bit, not cheap, but just like, well, you know, let's class them as even more monstrous.
Mm-hmm.
Than they already are, and also sort of put more responsibility on them outside of time and place. And there's this need to not just identify these people by name and like with pictures, which I am not 100 on that decision, but there is a drive to come in and fix it, I think, on Gibney's part, that doesn't, like, is ethically not super solid in terms of IDing these guys. And also because people on camera are like, oh no, I'm not giving names. I don't need my dog harmed. But also is not great narratively. So I mean, I think he just...
Yeah. Does he think that he can just Batman this thing into like, well, they put these guys in jail and then bam, we're halfway there, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the other puzzle as to the problems with the builds that you just cracked by using Batman as a verb. So, yeah. I mean,
yeah.
I should say, like, it's not horrible. It's just a kind of a pity. Especially from
him. I don't think the guy can make a bad movie. I think, you know, he's always reliable for something that's watchable, but this is not one of his better works at all. And there's so much other material that goes into this with much more understanding and nuance, which it needs. You know, it's not over. It's you know, it's
yeah.
really sadly not over. And yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't have to go into the, like, using the word serial killer, is that some way of, like, avoiding the word terrorist because that's so loaded now? But yeah. Then I'm not crazy about the fact that we throw the word terrorist around as much as we do. So, yeah, probably there's nothing to go with that either.
I just accused my cat of being one this morning. I stand by it.
Mm. I mean, I do too.
Look, I need those covers. I'm calling the police. Yeah. There is something about his need for the serial killer label that's kind of, it's just kind of everything that's not quite working about this movie. And I think if you did read Say Nothing, if you didn't read it, it's amazing. And if you have, this movie will feel kind of just like stuck to you. There is a pretty fun moment where a reporter is asked about a possible source's reaction to a report, in which everyone was able to have a bit of a laugh. So I'll play that last clip, and then I will ask if there's anything that you recommend watching instead. Here's clip 11.
I got the distinct impression that Mr. Carroll wanted to know more what we knew about him than what he was going to tell us about Loch and Island.
Did you show Albert Carroll the leaked report in which he was named?
Yes.
What was his reaction when he saw how much you knew about his role?
He shit himself. Yes. He was very defensive. Yes. Yeah, he was very defensive and edgy.
I mean, now there's a moment where, like, you see the sort of long tails of the tapestry hanging off, and that's fun.
Yeah.
Like, what really Gibney is looking for is like, well, he, you know, he seemed to be, he's like, oh yeah, he crapped himself. And then the Irish lilt makes it sound just rather like quaint and fun.
Yeah. And it's much needed break in the tension of that and the ominous, you know, stock footage that we're seeing up to the air.
Yeah. Oh yeah, for sure.
And it makes the people behind the, you know, the, there are a lot of really good people interviewed in this. And I kind of almost wish one of them was telling the story from their perspective.
Yeah.
You know, that reporter, like, he was gold. More of him. Like, yeah. What's he doing?
Barry McCaffrey. Yeah, he, Gibney gets excellent access. The reenactments are unfortunate, but, like, I guess as explainers go, it's fine. It's just, it's not in the top half of Gibney's best work. It's not something that I would recommend to give, like, good, compelling overview of the Troubles or of this murder or even this like week in world crime history. So yeah, it's a no for me, dog. Anything that you think listeners should watch or listen to or read instead?
I mean, I think for Gibney, like the trick with him is to find a topic, like look through what he's done, find a topic that he thinks really boring and he'll make it interesting for you. You know, I got into him through the Enron documentary, which is great. Client Nine is also, I mean, something I end up watching because it was on a double bill and I was like, I want to see the other thing. So I end up sitting through it and being like, oh my God, this is fucking great.
Yeah.
In terms of, like, I'm, you know, by no means, I'm very far away from being anywhere close to an expert on the Troubles or Ireland. But because of that, I would recommend there's a podcast series called The Irish Passport, which is two Irish people just chatting about Irish topics for non-Irish people in a way that's like, so you may have heard about this. Right. Let's just give you a little bit of a background. But it's done in a really nice way. And it's a good little explainer to a, you know, fascinating country and culture.
Oh, neat. I'm going to check that out. That will be in the show notes, along with a link to Say Nothing. And Bloody Sunday, I think.
Mm.
Always a good wreck.
Mm. Mm.
All right, speaking of wrecks.
In local news today, bees.
Mm-hmm. I'd love it if you could let listeners know where they can find more of your work.
Well, I'm occasionally on Jessica Crispin's podcast, Public Intellectual. I'm usually tucked away safely behind the Patreon paywall, but Public Intellectual is always worth a listen. And occasionally you even get me being definitely not remotely intellectual on it, talking about Shirley Jackson and ghost stories and popular culture and thus like. And I've got, like everyone in the world, I've got a newsletter, which is called 3 Weeks, that you can find at tinyletter.com/3 weeks. Comes up more or less every 3 weeks, hence the name.
Fantastic. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Coming up on The Blotter Presents, like I said, Dr. Marcia Chatelain's back to talk about, keep calling it Dirty Betty, and I think it's too late. It's just Dirty Betty now.
Really? I think it's just Dirty Betty.
I mean, you know, like a Dirty John, Ugly Betty. I just cannot get the name right. But y'all know what I mean, and I'm very excited to have Dr. Chatelain back on the show. At the end of the month, Mike Dunn, our official Golden State Killer correspondent, somehow, even though he and I are both from the Garden State, we'll be back to talk about the HBO docuseries I'll Be Gone in the Dark. In between, I'm sure something awesome will happen. I'm just not sure what it is yet. Speaking of awesome, if you've got a tip for The Blotter Presents, you can find me on social media, Blotter Presents on Twitter and Instagram, and it would be awesome if you reached out. I'm also on the Best Evidence newsletter, along with Margaret and others. That's at bestevidence.fyi. My guest has been Margaret Howie. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.